I've encountered a few of them. In my 30 years of church planting and pastoring, a few clergy killers have attempted to take my ministry down on things that had very little to do with me or my calling. I know other pastors and leaders in the ministry who have been sidetracked, taken out of ministry, even families destroyed. They never planned when they went to seminary that they would encounter a clergy killer. Now, in saying clergy killer, I'm not saying that they were physically killed, like murdered. This is a metaphor. The clergy killer is a metaphor of someone who just takes your ministry down on things that are not legitimate. The Apostle Paul had clergy killer attempted killings in his day. 2 Timothy 4:14, Alexander the metalworker did me a great deal of harm. The Lord will repay him for what he has done. You too should be on your guard against him because he strongly opposed our message. So in helping you develop people smart in ministry skills, my goal this week is to help you get on guard against potential clergy killers. That's a metaphor we're using, of course. So the next two sessions, this one and the next one, deals with identifying these clergy killers and what do you do about it. And then there's one session about you as a leader to not be an antagonistic leader that gets open to clergy killers. Anyway, in every church, there's the potential of clergy killers. And there are certain conditions that seem to happen. If I look at colleagues who were taken out of ministry, there's a certain common thread. And I'm going to read basically the story that has been repeated again and again and again. So you sort of get an idea what can happen. In fact, I would not be surprised if many of you have been part of a church where this actually happened. And it's sad that spiritual attack in Satan has had such a way in so many churches that these sort of things have happened. But anyway, I'm just going to talk about it now, and then we're going to talk about what the clergy killers actually look like. Who are they? Anyway, here's a typical scenario. The attack has actually been going on for some time. But the clergy killer, when the time is right, gets his plan of attack on the agenda of the official board of his church. He arranges for the minister not to be present. The board will be called to an executive session, meaning no outsiders are invited, and that includes the minister. Ministers and their staff members are usually outsiders to such official boards. At this crucial meeting, the clergy killer lays his charges before the assembled body of lay leaders. He will use statistics to bolster his accusations. A common target is church finances. Since most churches never have enough money, the shortage of money can be easily blamed on the minister's leadership. Now, these insights are taken from Guy Greenfield's book, Wounded Ministers, The Healing From and Preventing Personal Attacks. So here's a book, and there's other books out there like Well-Meant Dragons that are books that have given insights into these clergy killers and what to do about them. But anyway, the story keeps going on. It's like this. When the statistics are interpreted negatively, the finger of blame is pointed at the minister. The bottom line of the charges is very simple. If we get rid of our minister, all our problems will be solved, because he will bring a new and different minister who will lead us to new heights of statistical glory. If the accusing leader succeeds to this point, he will probably try to get a special committee appointed, hopefully his friends, to visit the minister in his office as soon as possible to pressure him to resign quietly for the sake of church unity in the future. By the time this happens, many ministers have been so harassed and worn out emotionally by all the accusations via phone calls, letters, some anonymous personal visits and rumors that they go as quickly and quietly as possible. The leadership crisis will eventually be brought before the congregation in some official capacity. where it is possible that open conflict will explode. Many ministers have friends and supporters who are caught unawares by the attempts to get rid of them, and these friends will rush to their support if at all possible. It may be too late to prevent the minister's resignation, but some kind of reactive response may take place, resulting in either a church split, where some ministers insist the resigned minister lead them to start a new congregation, or the departure of several members in an unorganized fashion to join other churches in town. So, at this point, the abused clergy person usually goes into clinical depression. After being rejected by the church that called him to be their pastor at one time, his wife and children also feel rejected. They may even stop attending church anywhere for a time. They usually feel some kind of public embarrassment over what happened to their husband and father. The clergy person's marriage may be severely strained, especially when there are acute financial needs. The collateral damage can be quite heavy and devastating. An already weak or troubled marriage may eventually collapse in separation and divorce, especially if the wife is the one who tends to be critical and blames her husband for their problems. Abused clergy often tell unbelievable stories of turning to their friends in ministry and to their denomination superiors for help in getting little, if any, positive assistance. It's as if they have some dreaded disease, and their friends, colleagues, and superiors keep their distance. Rarely does anyone come to their aid. So, this story has been told lots of times, hundreds, thousands of times. Like I mentioned earlier, in my church experience of 30 years, there have been the potential clergy killers, and honestly, I too had some near misses. So, who are these clergy killers? What kind of human beings are they? These are not normal people, average complainers, critics, typical dissidents who are generally unhappy about life itself. Generally, there are very few of them, one or two in an average congregation. But they are deadly and have a knack for gathering a following of ordinary folk with common complaints and disagreements in the church. They can easily create the illusion that there are hordes of people against the pastor. Really, they can create the illusion that there are hordes of people against the pastor. They are master at using the comments like these. They are very unhappy about, or the elusive people talking about, people are saying that, and at church on Sunday or in small group meetings, there's talk about there's a movement to get rid of the pastor. Now, let me be clear that I'm not using the term clergy killer to label the person who happens to disagree with a minister or his agenda. So I'm not talking about disagreement and stuff like that. Rather, I'm using this term, Guy Greenfield says, to identify persons who have a very mean-spirited disposition toward the minister in general and who intentionally target ministers for termination. So, let's talk about some of these clergy killer characteristics. First of all, they are destructive. The damage they want to inflict is intentional and deliberate. They are not out simply to disagree or find fault. They want to inflict pain in damaged persons. Their tactics include sabotage, subverting worthy causes, inciting others to do their dirty work, and causing victims to self-destruct. The clergy killer in my last pastorate used every one of these tactics to accomplish his goals, Guy Greenfield talks about. So they are destructive. Secondly, clergy killers are determined. They are headstrong and will stop at nothing. They may pause for a while, change strategies, even go underground to connect things, but they will come back with a vengeance to continue their intimidation, networking, breaking all rules of decency to accomplish their destructive objectives. For them, their plans have priority over all the programs of the church. These people are deceitful. Clergy killers are masters of manipulation, camouflage, misrepresentation, accusing others of their own atrocious deeds. Their comments and promises are not trustworthy. They're experts at twisting facts. Clergy killers are demonic, Guy Greenfield says. Psychologist M. Scott Peck said that there are some people so mean that the only adequate term to describe them is evil. These people in the church who target ministers for destruction may be mentally disordered, but they do not yield to patience or love, nor do they honor human decency. Apparently, clergy killers can carry around a lot of internal pain, confusion, anger, and even rage. Spiritual leaders, especially employed parish ministers, become available scapegoats for this pain and confusion, which is unidentified and untreated. Clergy killers, another characteristic is, you'll see, is there's denial on the part of church leaders that leaves clergy killers unrestrained, so that the whole church in general, and ministers in particular, are left extremely vulnerable to their wiles. The church tends to deny the seriousness of clergy killers and what they're about, and thus unknowingly cooperates in their agenda of destruction. So many in the church, well-intentioned people to be sure, do not wish to admit the reality of clergy killers and the intentional damage they cause. Believing that this evil should not happen in the church, we convince ourselves it really isn't happening. Kind-hearted church leaders often told me, "Oh, Pastor, this will all blow over. Don't take this so personally. The Lord will take care of this problem if we just keep praying about it." Another characteristic of the clergy killer cycle is clergy killers are expert at disguise, or they're expert at openly attacking. When they see it would be to their advantage, they're able to present themselves as pious, devout, spiritual church members who are doing their destructive work for the good of the church to advance God's kingdom. They can convince naive church members that they are raising legitimate issues. These religious monsters often hide among their allies of opportunity whose members they have charmed into friendship, who are also congregational power brokers, and others who are disgruntled with the church for one reason or another. So, here's the scenario repeated over and over again. So, as a potential leader in the church, what are some of the best practices of thriving in a world where clergy killers do in fact exist? Well, first of all, don't accept a call to a church without sensing the total buy-in from the key leaders. This is the first way of attempting to keep clergy killers very minimal. If you accept a call to a church, let's say they have a church committee, but the committee is not connected to the elders or the leaders of the church, but they recommend to the elders that you should be called to their church. Be very, very careful that the elders buy in that search committee's recommendation. You know what I would love to see? Is I'd love to see that if you're called by a church committee, that you meet with the elders and really get that prayerful sense there's buy-in. Second, don't lead in a building project that exposes you to excessive risk. One of the things that I got to tell you, when I faced potential clergy killers, it was around a building project. In fact, the two times related something to building projects. So be very, very careful that building projects are the place where you have the complete buy-in of the elders and deacons, so that they're there to cover you if you're out there communicating about the building project. Number three, don't allow someone to get the over-volunteer syndrome. Now, what that is this, if let's say there's some programs of the church, and one person volunteers, then the same person volunteers to help another program, and this volunteer becomes at church all of the time. It seems like they're there every day, they're volunteering and volunteering. I have usually seen that over volunteering layperson can start having controlling issues, like it should go my way. I'm actually putting more time in the pastor. A lot of times, people who are burning out become antagonists. Now, I will tell you that sometimes it's not related to volunteers at all. It's related to volunteering at all. It's just related to their own background. Number four, set up a pastor's church council with key leaders of the church whose task is to be aware of clergy killers. You know, what I did over the years is right away I got a couple of my elders. I even brought material like this before them so that we would create sort of like a response team. If someone all of a sudden just started having a bad attitude, all the elders and deacons were aware of this. We'll talk about these things in elders' meetings and even say, if anybody becomes an antagonist, a clergy killer as an elder, let's just, you know, say that I have tendencies to this right now. In other words, self-aware discussion where key leaders are talking about the potential of this kind of situation, that is very much leadership people smart. Number five, keep developing your leadership so that you do not raise up clergy killers. In other words, as you get to be a better leader and have more buy-in and more constructive participation with your elders and leaders and all your staff and so forth, it seems like that good leadership, you find that there are less clergy killers that even come up. They're still possibly there, but good leadership is a great way to prevent a lot of them. Number six, seek out experienced pastors and mentors to help you discern how to lead in your local situation. In other words, this is not anything new. As pastors and leaders, anyone who's been experienced in the pastorate have encountered clergy killers. So as a leader, the best practices are just to look at your leadership and develop a team to help you. Number seven, develop the peacefire.net base of knowledge in your leadership. At Christian Leaders Institute, we have partnered with peacefire.net, www.peacefire.net, and this is about God is at work in conflict and learn the best practices of helping people through conflict. If you want to thrive, keep conflict in your church at a minimum. Number eight, identify possible very divisive people and deal with these problems that are raised up as soon as possible. You know, in my ministry over the years, God has shown me that that is a very divisive person. And when we read in Scripture that, you know, warned a divisive person once and at not, if after once, the person needs to leave the church. As I got older and more experienced, and I saw divisive people, I made sure that I let it be clear that, you know, this church is not your vision, or I can see the vision of this church and your vision is very different. Many times these antagonist clergy killers are really at the wrong church. And part of helping someone is to help them find the church that's the church where they best can participate at. Number nine, learn how to expect problems, talk them through. Once you've identified problems and issues have been addressed, forgive quickly. Don't be a pastor that carries bitterness. Learning as you go, and then after these various things, be resilient. So put everything on the table. Keep everything as communicative with your leaders as possible. Be on team with your leaders. And yes, there may be clergy killers. Do a Bible study on the dissension passages with your elders and deacons. And if you're starting a church or you're starting a new pastorate, do it right at the start. Develop a plan to deal with dissension should it occur. That's right. So what's on the agenda? Let's talk about dissension even before we get dissension. Dissension, and I would also talk about it. Let's talk about dissension against the elder or deacon leadership. Let's talk about dissension against the leadership of the pastors or the church staff. Let's talk about the passage of dissension. Let's talk about doctrine in life and what are the expectations of my fulfilling a good calling at this church. All of these discussions, if they're put on the table early, are the best practices of thriving in a world with clergy killers. Number 11. Don't take yourself too seriously. Just, you know, there is going to be clergy killers. There's going to be dissension because we know in the Bible we're promised that there will be. So you can't take ministry so intensely emotional and that your failure, your success, your family somehow or other know that things bad will happen and there will be attacks. But somehow, as by the power of the Holy Spirit and a well-walked call with God, what you'll find is that all of this resistance that you're going to have, the spiritual warfare, will make you stronger and a better leader. You will be a mentor for other leaders someday from what you've learned in your journey. And last, just commit yourself to pray. You know, one of the things my wife and I pray is we always pray that, Lord, you will take us through the next obstacle. And we'll try new things, and some things we'll see God blesses and others God says no to, or learn this and move on. But even when it comes to clergy killers, pray for those who attack you. Not pray that they'll get judged, but pray that the Lord will change their heart. And pray that if there's the slightest element of truth to anything they have to say, pray that you will learn it quickly and move on. You know, this is a very difficult thing for pastors, and many pastors leave ministry over these clergy killers. But to be people smart in ministry is to be aware of the personal dynamics, the interpersonal dynamics that create the situation where clergy killers can sidetrack your ministry. And we don't want that to happen, because you are an operative for Christ. As you are in ministry, possibly ordained for ministry, you have an opportunity to change lives for God. The Holy Spirit will use you. So we want you to be people smart about these situations so that you can do very well in ministry.